Welcome back to On the Evidence. I'm your host, J.B. Wogan. This week, we're going to take a slightly different approach from other episodes. Rather than focus on a new paper or book, I've brought in three guests to take a deep dive on a topic: medical patients with complex needs who represent a small fraction of the overall patient population, but a large share of healthcare use and costs. I first became interested in this issue last fall when some of my colleagues here at Mathematica published a study evaluating a high-intensity team-managed care model that aimed to reduce healthcare use and costs among this group of patients. Today, we'll hear from one of the authors of that study, Purvi Sevak. The model she helped evaluate, which has been tried in four states, was inspired by a program in Camden, New Jersey that Atul Gawande profiled in The New Yorker in 2011. That piece by Gawande synthesized eye-catching data with anecdotes that illustrated why someone might end up in the emergency room or intensive care unit multiple times a year, racking up medical bills. For example, there's a story about a patient named Frank Hendricks, not his real name, who had severe congestive heart failure, chronic asthma, uncontrolled diabetes, hypothyroidism, gout, and a history of smoking and alcohol abuse. He weighed 560 pounds. And the physician in the story, a family doctor named Jeffrey Brenner, provides intensive, personalized care to figure out what's going on with Frank. Dr. Brenner gets a nurse practitioner to make home visits to check Frank's blood sugar levels and blood pressure. He also gets a social worker to get Frank signed up for disability insurance so he can get access to stable housing and a consistent set of physicians. Dr. Brenner and his team also get Frank to start cooking for himself and to attend Alcoholics Anonymous. And sure, this is anecdotal information, but the results are stunning. Frank stops drinking, smoking, and using cocaine. He loses 220 pounds, which, to quote the article, means that if he falls, he can pick himself up rather than having to call for an ambulance. Dr. Brenner establishes a nonprofit based on this model of care called the Camden Coalition of Healthcare Providers. The New Yorker story notes that for the first 36 patients the coalition treats, the average visits per month to the hospital and the emergency room drops from 62 visits a month to 37 visits a month. And the hospital bills for those patients drops 56%, from an average of $1.2 million per month to just over $500,000 per month. Caveats abound, of course, in extrapolating too much from the results, which lacked a comparison or control group, but they were encouraging enough for federal funders to pay for demonstration projects based on the same idea. As you can imagine, lots of players in the healthcare space are interested in how we might rein in medical use and costs for this small but important segment of the patient population. And as it turns out, Mathematica has a deep bench of in-house experts on this very topic. In the past few years, we've published papers on examining different managed care programs, and we've looked at how patients view their experience at these programs. In addition to Purvi Sevak, our other two guests, Dana Jean-Baptiste and Anne O'Malley, have written some of these papers. So the following conversation is a primer of sorts on patients with complex needs and high costs. What do we know about them? What do we know about how to care for them? And what don't we know yet? I hope you enjoy the conversation. My guests today are Purvi Sevak, an economist at Mathematica. Purvi, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, JB.
And Anne O'Malley, a physician and primary care researcher here at Mathematica.
Hi, JB. Thank you.
And Dana Jean-Baptiste, a healthcare researcher here.
Thanks for having me.
So I was hoping we could start the conversation by talking a little bit about an article that had come to my attention early in my time here at Mathematica. An article by Atul Gawande that was in The New Yorker back in 2011 about hotspotters. And it often comes up when I'm talking to people here internally about patients with complex needs and high costs. So, you know, what kind of impact did it have? And, you know, did it present any kinds of new information, or did it frame the information in a new way? What do you all think?
Well, I think it was a really nice articulation of existing information, but the way it was presented and was much more accessible to a large readership than, say, articles that come out in medical journals or health policy publications. His description of Dr. Brenner's work was really engaging, and this kind of concept of hot spotting that Dr. Brenner himself was doing was new in healthcare. But attention on that focus group of a small percentage of patients who account for a high proportion of healthcare spending is not a new topic. That's kind of been a focus in research and policy circles for years.
And can you could you define what when we say hotspotters, what's the, or if one of you want to take it, but what do we mean when we say hotspotters?
Sure. So, JB, hotspotting offers a way to find these patients. It's been used earliest in crime by mapping crime and finding clusters, areas where there's lots of crime. In terms of high utilizers, hotspotting can be used to identify the patients that have high spending, high utilization, and that are likely to have these complex health needs. In Dr. Brenner's work, they identified clusters that were concentrated in apartment buildings in particular neighborhoods. It's really a way to identify the patients who you want to target by this program.
And I mean, my takeaway from the article, was that there's this line midway through where Atul Gawande is talking about Dr. Brenner, and he's saying that he wasn't as interested in the cost aspect of the patients, but he started to realize that by identifying the patients with the highest cost, that was a way of also identifying those with the highest need or who were receiving the worst care, and that maybe if you could identify those patients, then you'd be able to do something to help them.
I was going to say, as a physician, as a primary care physician, that was clearly his approach in wanting to do the best for these patients. There's also a lot of kind of in policy and insurance circles, there's a lot of pressure to focus on the high-cost patients to save money. But, it is true that those two things travel together, that the ones with the greatest needs are typically the ones with the highest costs.
Okay. Dina, actually, you wrote a nice blog post for us that was sort of summarizing some of the issues around patients with high costs and high needs. And one of the things that I've wondered about is who the patients are and what do we know about them and what do they have in common? And so, what do we know?
Yeah, good question, JB. So Anne and I did some work where we looked to see how different healthcare delivery organizations were identifying their high need, high cost patients. And to kind of frame the discussion around what we mean by high cost, high need patients, there's a definition that the National Academy of Medicine uses. Well, it's a definition that has like three criteria to really define what a high cost, high need patient actually means. And the three criteria that they use is that these patients have high total accrued healthcare costs. They also have high intensity of healthcare utilization over like a given period of time. And lastly, these patients have functional limitations. And when I say limitations, these can include limitations with activities of daily living, such as dressing yourself, grooming yourself, or bathing yourself. So I think that definition really helps to kind of explain who these patients are. But some of the changes that we've seen, since the Atul Gawande article is that one glaring realization that we have about these high cost, high need patients is that they all have very heterogeneous needs, and there's no one-size-fits-all solution to help address these needs. And these patients are very diverse. They have complex issues. They're expensive, and they're also dynamic because their needs can change over time. And another realization is that within these needs, a lot of these needs also include unmet social and behavioral health needs. And when I say social needs, I'm talking about housing instability, food insecurity, and transportation. And in terms of behavioral health needs, that can include things like depression and schizophrenia. So as you can see, these patients are very diverse and they have differing needs.
So from what I understand, each of you have looked at sort of attempts to try and help patients with high costs and high needs in various ways today. Maybe you could just give me some examples of what's going on in the country and what progress we've made in trying to help these patients.
So there are other programs that share some characteristics of the CAMDA model. I think one of the biggest types of things people are trusting right now is the use of care managers. And so a care manager is basically, the definition is not universally accepted, and the effectiveness of care managers generally has not been well established yet. The data is quite mixed on it. But it basically refers to a person, typically a nurse, who works closely with the patient's primary care physician, ideally in their practice, to kind of enhance the care that the primary care physician and team are already giving the patient. And that care manager really kind of reaches out to the patient between visits to make sure that their chronic conditions are being well monitored and managed. They try to catch things early before they get to a crisis point and, you know, before they require a visit to the emergency room or to the hospital. And so there are lots of different models out there right now being tested. One of the biggest models, and this doesn't apply just to the high-need, high-cost patients, this applies to primary care patients generally, one of the FIT models is called the Comprehensive Primary Care Plus, and it is, to date, the largest and most ambitious primary care payment and delivery reform ever tested in the U.S. It's funded by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, and it was rolled out in 21 regions across the United States. And the goal of this CPC Plus model is to really bolster support for primary care practices. And the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid partnered with 79 public and private payers across these 21 regions in the U.S. And they're reaching a huge number of patients, over 15 million patients, and the primary care providers are taking part in this. And the goal of this initiative really is not, it's not just focused on high-need, high-cost patients. It's focused on bolstering primary care, which we know has been insufficiently supported in this country, certainly compared to other democratic and Western industrialized democracies in the world. And to bolster primary care both by improving payment for primary care as well as improving the infrastructure and staffing for primary care. And so one of the ways that CPC Plus does this is to emphasize this concept of, you know, identifying who are your high-need, high-cost patients. You know, who is that top, typically 3 to 5% of patients in your primary care practice who are attributing, you know, account for the most expenditures of all your patient panel as a provider. And, you know, really focusing in on giving those patients the extra attention, the extra care management that they need, not just when they're in the office, but between visits by phone and through remote monitoring and all kinds of other ways. So I think that's the piece of CPC Plus that's most similar to what we're discussing here with these, with Camden and the other models. It also puts a fairly big emphasis on improving the comprehensiveness of primary care, in particular improving the way patients' social support needs are recognized by a primary care practice and trying to coordinate between primary care and community-based resources that support patients' social needs, as well as making sure that they address patients' behavioral or mental health needs, because we know that, you know, all of those things combined can really compromise a person's ability to manage their health conditions. So I think that's probably the biggest example of something that's going on right now, you know, to try to address, you know, primary care for all, but it also that high-need, high-cost population is a subgroup within that.
I can speak about one program that replicated the Camden model, and like it, targeted patients with very high levels of hospital use and spending who had complex health needs and socioeconomic challenges. That program was led by Rutgers University, and it used funding from a healthcare innovation award from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Innovation, and Mathematica did the evaluation of the program, which is how I'm familiar with it. So Rutgers University helped four organizations that were very different: an independent physicians association in California, a nonprofit community health center in Colorado, a nonprofit health system that was affiliated with two hospitals in Kansas City, Missouri, and a nonprofit operator of two federally qualified health centers in Allentown, Pennsylvania, to set up programs modeled after the Camden program. The program focused on development of individualized care plans and integrated care management services through the use of mobile care teams that met patients in the community as opposed to meeting them, you know, in the hospital or at a doctor's office. The care teams, which included some combination of nurses and community health care workers and social workers, met with patients frequently. They provided education about the importance of using primary and specialty care. They also accompanied them to doctor's appointments, helped them make doctor's appointments. The patients in the program met the profile of the population that we're talking about. On average, they had 7 chronic conditions. Most had additional behavioral health conditions as well. In the year prior to their involvement with the program, they had an average of 4 inpatient hospital admissions and 5 visits to the emergency department.
Hey,
and their spending,
hey,
their Medicare spending. Yeah.
Sorry. Just one question for clarification. In terms of, I'm sure people with an expertise in healthcare would already know this, but what are examples of chronic conditions and behavioral health conditions?
Sure, absolutely. So in the population that was enrolled in this program, the chronic conditions we saw most frequently were diabetes, hypertension, chronic kidney disease. We saw depression, schizophrenia, and some other behavioral health conditions. And hand-in-hand with that, their spending was very high. Their Medicare beneficiaries that we were able to study, their annual spending averaged $70,000, which is about seven times the national average among Medicare fee-for-service beneficiaries. So as I mentioned, we led an evaluation of this program, and what we found was that the program resulted in a reduction in service use. In particular, we found that the program reduced unplanned readmissions by about a third.
So one big picture question for me is, what are the stakes? Why does this particular group of patients matter? And who's it matter to? Why is it important to try and figure out ways of identifying these patients and improving the treatment of care for these patients?
That's a really good question, JB. I think that there's, when you mentioned the Gawande article, you touched on this a bit, and that some are motivated by cost, trying to find ways to reduce healthcare spending. The high utilizers represent a disproportionate share of the cost, so if you can improve their care and reduce costs, it might make a dent in aggregate costs. But another motivation is to help these patients because they're not being served well. They're not getting the care that they need, despite the fact that they are getting they have high levels of service use, high levels of spending. They're not getting the care that they need in the most helpful way. So I think that there's multiple motivations for the community to be interested in this population.
And maybe I'm misrecalling this statistic, but there was some statistic about that these patients represent, they're 5% of the Medicaid and Medicare patient population, but they're more than 50% of costs or something like that. Is that right?
I think you're referring to a statistic that 5% of the whole U.S. population has complex medical and behavioral or social needs, but they account for 50% of the country's healthcare spending. So it's not just limited to Medicare or Medicaid. So that, for 5% of the whole U.S. population to account for 50% of all of our spending is pretty alarming. And that, I believe it was Dr. Cohen who published that work back in 2012 or so. But the point is, it's when you hear that kind of a statistic, people obviously want to gravitate toward, like, okay, what's the solution? And they do tend to carve out that population and, try to come up with something that's almost a silver bullet, which, I think that approach is, not everyone agrees with that approach, but it's certainly the approach that a lot of payers are taking right now.
Dana, you were just shaking your head about the silver bullet thing. Do you have something to add to that?
I mean, the only thing I would add is that I, agree with Anne, because some of the examples I think of that we've talked about before and, I've seen in the literature is that there's these patients who they have varying needs. So it's not like if you put the one-size-fits-all, like I said beforehand, solution that's going to help just, that one patient and going to help all other patients that may have similar needs or may have different needs. It's just that a lot of times it takes a lot of tailoring of services, and sometimes those are care management services and other services. But I think that this is what makes it so complicated, is that there is no silver bullet.
So,
I think what's uniformly recognized, and it's the theme from all three of us, is that, it's increasingly obvious that if you don't address a patient's underlying social and behavioral health needs, it's awfully hard to get their medical conditions under control. And those three things often, can travel together. So, if a patient's got really poorly controlled diabetes and they have major depression and they live in a low-income area and can't afford healthy foods, I mean, there's no way you're going to get their diabetes under control until you've, helped them with that healthy food, access to healthy food supply, ensured that they've got the money to pay the copays for their diabetes medications, and treated their depression so that they have the motivation to get up in the morning and move and exercise and do all the things you need to do behaviorally to control your diabetes.
I guess the one thing we haven't talked about yet is we've been talking a little bit about with the healthcare industry or what the various perspectives, but not so much from the patient perspective. So, you know, these care models that you've been describing, what do the patients actually think about them?
Well, we did, as part of our evaluation at Mathematica of the comprehensive primary care, the initial initiative, which was from 2012 through 2016, we interviewed patients who were working with, you know, a care manager and physician at their primary care practices, and who were high-risk and complex patients. And we asked the patients, you know, what's your experience like working with this care manager? Most often this was a nurse who's been trained in helping a patient manage, you know, giving them enhanced support for managing their conditions in addition to what they do with the doctor. And what we heard from patients was that some patients questioned whether they even needed a care manager. And if they felt they needed one, and if they were willing to engage with a care manager, then they tended to have very positive experiences. So in this model, the care manager is located at the primary care practices for the most part. They worked as part of a team very closely with the patient's primary care doc. The patients really valued the time that care managers spent listening to them and explaining things to them in lay terms, something that, you know, ideally physicians would be doing, but they don't always have the time in our current fee-for-service system, where volume of, you know, visits is rewarded over taking time to spend with a patient. And so in some ways, the kind of this use of care managers is a little bit of a way to compensate for how misaligned our fee-for-service incentives are in the U.S. But patients, you know, having said that, patients did find the care managers helpful in terms of managing their medications, their chronic conditions in between visits, and particularly after having, if they had been hospitalized, following up after that, getting them back into the office to meet with the doc and make sure that, you know, their medications were correct, et cetera. Patients also told us that when they did work with the care manager, they felt they had increased access to their primary care physician because that care manager kind of had an in. So if they were going through, you know, a really hard time, the care manager was able to get that patient access to the doctor sooner than if they had just maybe called the front desk. And then lastly, patients liked that the care managers helped them to navigate the healthcare system and, you know, resources in the community for things like social supports. Some of these care managers also, I should say, were social workers as well. So that's just one study of one subgroup of complex patients who worked with care managers. There hasn't been a ton of work, honestly, asking patients what their experience with this type of model is, in part because it's really hard. These are complex patients. They can be very frail, and it's really hard to get them on the phone to do an interview with them. And so, and you know, talking about some of these issues can be kind of complex. So there haven't been a lot of studies like this, but hopefully there will be more going forward.
Okay, so we've covered a little bit of what we've learned in the past, but in terms of looking ahead, what questions do you still have about the patient population, about how to care for the patients? What questions haven't been answered yet, but you hope will be in the future?
Sure. So there's a lot that we don't know about which patients might be more responsive to high-intensity care management programs than others. As Dana mentioned, this is a very diverse population with, you know, while they have, you know, multiple chronic conditions, the conditions they have vary, their, you know, social supports vary. Studies have just begun to identify the fact that some groups might benefit more than others from these programs. Future studies should fine-tune ways to identify them in the population, how to identify those that are most likely to benefit. We also don't know how these patients that are participating in these programs fare in the long run. These programs, at least the one implemented by Rutgers that I spoke about, are intense and cannot keep patients enrolled forever. So the goal is for them to teach the patients how to navigate the primary care system and then graduate from these programs. As a result, most studies have been focused on short-term or maybe outcomes over a year or 2 years. Future studies should examine the long-term costs and also the long-term benefits of these programs to see if any of the benefits some of the programs claim to have persist over multiple years. And if not, studies should examine how to help these patients and, you know, maintain those benefits over a longer period of time.
Okay. And I asked this question because I remember in our pre-call that we talked a little bit about sort of what the problems are with short-term studies, and I think it was reverting to the mean, but what's the danger of drawing strong conclusions from sort of short-term improvements in outcomes?
Sure. So a lot of these programs identify patients, their target population, by recent high levels of service use or spending. And if you look at the patterns of service use and spending among many patients, sometimes they have a crisis that results in a spike in their service use. And after that crisis goes away, it comes down. So it's not, you know, they might have high spending, high service use on average, but there are periods where it goes up and down. And so the risk in short-term studies is that you enroll patients when they're at that peak, at that spike, and we know that their service use and spending on average comes down. That's called reverting to the mean. And so you might think that it's because of the program, but it's just that that's the pattern that we see in general. And so it's really important for these studies to compare the outcomes of the patients that they've enrolled in the program to a comparison group that's not enrolled in the program, but that's really very, very similar, to see how much more the, you know, outcomes of the patients in the program improve relative to the patients that are not enrolled in the program. And again, it's important to then think about, okay, maybe they improve their outcomes for a few months or a year. What happens when the next crisis rolls around? You know, do they recover faster or better, stronger, like they did when they were enrolled in the program? Or do they now look like, you know, the complex patients that were never enrolled in the program?
Okay.
And I'll add, JB, in addition to all the stuff Purvi just said, which is spot on, another reason for having longer-term studies is that transforming how healthcare is delivered takes a lot of time. And so, you know, even in these primary care pilots and demonstrations where, you know, CMS and other payers are trying to improve support for primary care, maybe, you know, change the way they pay for primary care to get away from some of the misaligned financial incentives of fee-for-service, maybe bolster the support within the practice for communicating, you know, within and across practices through health information technology, maybe bringing in staff like social workers or care managers to kind of help the primary care physician work closely with patients. All of that takes time, and it takes time to hire people. It takes time to hire the right people and train them to do these roles. It takes time for those people, you know, to kind of become part of the primary care team at the practice and be accepted by the physician and vice versa. And it, you know, it takes years, you know, a couple of years at least for that, just those things to happen. And so many of these evaluation programs, as Purvi said, are so short term that they don't really let the work get off the ground before they try to measure outcomes. And so that's why, you know, CPC Plus, for example, is a long year, a multi-year initiative. And as she said, the other critical piece is the comparison group. You really, you know, these pre-post studies in that are done often where people claim big savings are highly suspect. If you don't have a comparison group that's well-matched to your group that's getting the intervention, then you really, it's very hard to make draw a strong conclusion about the effectiveness of the program.
So are any of you working on something now that might get at some of these questions or that might deepen our understanding of patients with high costs and high needs?
Yeah, so I'm working on a project called the Accountable Health Communities. Mathematica is actually the learning system contractor. And Accountable Health Communities, or AHC for short, is a model that's trying to address the gap between clinical care and community services. So what we're doing in this model is really testing whether systematically identifying and addressing Medicare and Medicaid beneficiaries' health-related social needs will in any way impact healthcare costs and reduce healthcare utilization. And the way that the program is set up to address these health-related social needs is through screening, referral, and community navigation. And the way that this model is set up is that there's 31 community groups, also known as bridge organizations, that are the ones that are identifying these beneficiaries' health-related social needs and then leveraging community resources to address those needs. And the project looks at five core needs. It's food, housing, transportation, transportation, utilities, and safety. So what we do through the learning system is that we provide these bridge organizations with educational content and technical assistance to really help them in effectively partnering with their clinical organizations and also community service providers to meet the beneficiaries' needs. And I think what this project does is that it's really helping to demonstrate the importance or the recognition that it's important to identify these health-related social needs and to find ways to address them. Now, the model is in its third year, so in the evaluation, I think it's taking place right now. So we still don't know what the results are, but I do think it does show the need to actually test and look at how we can address beneficiaries' needs.
The only other question I thought about maybe asking, I know there are a few different times where you talked about social determinants of health. I can't remember if you actually used the term, but it seems to me like that's an underlying part of the conversation is the healthcare system addressing the social determinants of health. Is that a through line of all of this research?
I mean, I think, it's not the healthcare system's job to provide all the social supports to people in the U.S. That's why we have housing and transportation and food agencies. But it is important for people in the healthcare setting to recognize when patients come to them with those kinds of needs, because absent addressing those needs, it's awfully hard to help them improve their health and live with their chronic conditions, or at least, minimize the problems that they're going to have from chronic conditions. So we're in a real bind in this country because the system, our systems for social support in this country, whether it's housing, transportation, honestly, insurance coverage, food, security in your neighborhood, et cetera, security at home as an elder, we just invest so much less in that than other countries in Western industrialized democracies. And it ends up in really materializing in a lot of ways in people's health. And so you see these huge socioeconomic disparities in health, by income, by race, and by where people live, et cetera, that, in other countries aren't nearly as exaggerated. And so it ends up becoming a problem for the healthcare system, and obviously it's a problem for the people of this country. And so this is just one way that we're, trying to address it, I think, as a nation, how to make up for that inadequate investment.
And Anne, I would add that example that you gave about the diabetic patient with depression is like a perfect example to demonstrate why this is so important, because as you mentioned, until you address that patient's underlying depression, you're not going to see any changes in the patient's behavior or their healthcare outcomes. So I think it really just enforces the point that you just made, Anne, that you have to think about it. Like, there's no other way to address the issues that we're having with healthcare costs.
Thanks again to our guests, Purvi, Dana, and Anne. To read excerpts of our interview, check out our blog on the Mathematica website. In the show notes, we'll include all the studies referenced in our conversation. To hear more episodes from On the Evidence, subscribe on Apple Podcasts or SoundCloud. If you like what you hear, please rate us and leave us a review on iTunes. You can also keep up with the latest episodes by following me on Twitter @JBWogan.